The reason we're meeting at all is basically because April Curtis and Brian asked if we would start teaching a little about Buddhism. So that's why this is happening. This is the second year now. We're beginning the second year of doing this. And since there's so many folks here who are new, I think it would be helpful for me to introduce myself and tell you why I'm doing this, how come I'm doing this, how I can do this, and the same for Kay. And actually, that's quite traditional in the Buddhist lineage, is if you're going to open your mouth, you better explain why you have some reason for opening your mouth. Otherwise, you should keep your mouth shut. And that would be my tendency. And in fact, when we first got here, a number of people asked me to teach over the years, and I said no, no, no. But after a while, it seemed that I couldn't say no to my friends, so I said yes. But I started studying Buddhism in the mid-1960s with someone called Thich Thich Nhat Hanh, a Vietnamese Buddhist monk in Los Angeles, and have continued on in various ways studying with various kinds of teachers. What's relevant is that for some slightly insane reason, I got a PhD in Tibetan in the 70s. So I have an academic side to myself, and I've taught at universities. But that's not the basis upon which I've been teaching here. The basis upon which I've been teaching here are the what I've learned from my four main teachers. So I'll just tell you who they are, and then we'll just get on from there. One is Geshe Sonam Rinchen, who... you don't have to know what these names mean. But anyway, he's the head teacher of the Library of Tibetan Works and Archives in Dharamsala, which is a sort of a school that was set up by the Tibetan refugee community. Another one is called Tara Tulku Rinpoche, who is a retired abbot of Gyuto Monastery. And if you've ever seen any traveling monks around doing various performances, he's the one who invented that idea as a fundraiser for his monastery. After his death, Denma Lhotse Rinpoche, who is at that time had just retired as abbot of Namgyal Monastery, which is the Dalai Lama's personal monastery. So Kayla and I have been studying with him since 1993, right? And before that, both of us with Tara Tulku since 1996. Thank you.
And you earlier.
And myself earlier. And then also we're students of the Dalai Lama, and we've been fortunate enough to take literally uncountable numbers of teachings from him over the years. We just made it a point to do that. So if I have anything to say that's of value to anybody, it's coming from them, and I hope I don't screw it up. It certainly isn't coming from me. So that's the basis upon which I'll be teaching. Specifically, though, what's happening at this particular point in time is that last weekend we were meeting with another one of our teachers. His name is Chujie Rinpoche, and he has a group in Yakima, and Kay asked, would you come to Le Grand? He's been here once before. You may have seen him. He did some teachings at the old Quaker meeting house about 3 years ago. I can't say as I remember who was there except for Kayla and I were there. I know that, but I don't remember who else was there. So he's coming probably in the second half of November because Kay asked, would you come and would you do a particular teaching, which is a teaching of Green Tara, who is a female form of the Buddha that looks like that painting above the mantle there. That's Kay's painting. Among other things, she's a Tonka painter. Tonkas are Tibetan style icons. And he, shockingly, to Kay, who almost fainted when he said, yeah, sure, I'll come. She was surprised, and so was everybody else there. So the thing is, though, that what I thought I would do at this particular juncture is to begin to prepare for his visit. Because we have probably three meetings before he comes, and then he will do an initiation into Green Tara for people who want to practice that. So what does that mean? And, you know, so on and so forth. So I thought what I would do over the next few meetings is sort of lay the foundation for that as best I could. So if that is something that you want to do, you'll have some sort of framework for understanding what's he doing, what is the practice, why would you do it, and that sort of thing. That's actually a tall order, but I'll give it a try. I don't really think it's impossible. So before I go any farther, are any questions about anything that I've just said that requires any clarification? Probably everything that I've just said requires clarification. No? Okay. This particular practice in this Tibetan tradition of Green Tara is one of a class of practices that have to do with transforming one's identity as a way of making a deeper contact with one's innermost nature. And in the Buddhist tradition, one's innermost nature is called one's Buddha nature. Everyone's potentially a Buddha. The Buddha is just somebody that we know of who achieved that kind of fulfillment, total fulfillment of his innermost nature. Not even first, because there were Buddhas before him, but he's known to us historically, and he's known to the Buddhist tradition historically, and in fact, he formulated a specific way of teaching, which is what we now call Buddhism. But he's actually not unique. In the Buddhist tradition, there were countless Buddhas before him, and there have been Buddhas since him. They're not necessarily known to us. I mean, if I ran into somebody who was enlightened, which is enlightened means somebody who's found their innermost nature, their Buddha nature, I doubt that I would even know that I had run into a Buddha, because I would be too dense to notice it. Right? But they had been around. And our friend Bob Thurman has observed that one of the things that's particularly interesting about the Tibetan tradition is, unlike many Buddhist traditions that suggest, well, there was a Buddha, but that was an unusual achievement, and there haven't been any since then, in the Tibetan tradition, they think, yeah, sure, there are Buddhas around. There's probably one on the other valley right over there, on the other side of those mountains. And that actually changes the way you think about practice, and you think about what you're doing on your spiritual path, because the idea is anybody can do it. If you apply yourself, you can do it. You can achieve that quality of your own Buddha nature, your own enlightenment nature. I mean, it's not like it's an easy thing to do, but it is doable. But as I said, I suppose if you became a Buddha, you would know it. But if you ran into somebody who was, you might not know it. And all the people I know who were particularly spiritually developed in the Buddhist tradition, if you ask them about what they've achieved, they always say, nothing. They say, if they're not modest, it's a sign that they ought to be. Well, never mind. I don't want to go to that. We maybe don't want to go to that. Anyway, so back to what I was saying earlier, and I'm going to try and kind of keep my thoughts formulated or my ideas sort of on track within this specific context, sort of preparing for this teaching that Zajo Jay will offer for anybody who's interested in it. And so that I'll keep coming back to that rather than just sort of drifting off or doing some of the things I might otherwise do. So I said earlier that this is about changing one's identity, or working with one's identity, this kind of teaching, in order to find one's deepest nature. And the underlying assumption that should become apparent right away is that obviously there's a difference between what I actually am and who I think I am, if I even say something like that. If I say, this teaching is about changing one's identity to find one's deepest nature, implied in that is that one's identity is other than one's deepest nature now. Doesn't have to be, but it is now. And in the Buddhist context, one's identity is probably one of the things that's standing between one and one's deepest nature. Now, that's an interesting comment to make, given what I earlier said about if you ask somebody if they have any realization, they're going to say, nah, you know. But in a certain way, it actually does fit, but I'm not going to go there right now. So in the Buddhist tradition, the way one begins to understand one's identity and therefore understands how one can begin to practice with one's identity so that one can change one's identity and find their deepest nature, the way they begin talking about this is in a very simple analytic way. And this goes back to the time of the Buddha, which is, what is it you got with you right now that you can observe? I mean, no metaphysics. Buddhists aren't big on metaphysics. I mean, that stuff can creep in, but that's not the foundational kinds of issue. What do you have right now that's the basis of your experience and upon which you claim to be me? Whether me is Kayla, David, Brian, Loy, anybody. Doesn't make any difference. Same question. What is the basis upon which your identity exists? So the Buddha, and this goes back to the time of the historic Buddha, Shakyamuni Buddha, which is now over 2,500 years ago. The Buddha said, well, let's start with what you got, and let's look at what you got, and what's really here. So what do we know about what's really here? Let's be real simple about it. Well, one thing we know is you have a body. You got stuff, matter. That's pretty incontrovertible. So that's one thing you know about who you are and what you are and what your identity is based on. The other thing you know is you're aware of your body and you're asking this question. So you have what could be called a mind, or you have what could be called consciousness. These are words that require some definition. But you're aware of your body. So that's two things that you know for sure. That you've got awareness or consciousness, and you've got a body. Now, what you don't know necessarily is how they relate to each other. And in the West, that's sort of a big problem. So the Buddha says, well, what else do we know? He said, well, one of the things we know is that if you have awareness and you have a body, their relationship is that awareness is aware of the body. That's something called perception. So we know that you experience perception. And the Buddha points out that perception is something you experience through multiple sense organs. That you can be aware of your body, you can see it, you can touch it, you can smell it, you can taste it, you can hear it, sort of. I mean, I don't know. You can hear it, okay. And you can know it, because in Buddhist thought, there are six sense organs, one of which is what we call the mind, in the sense of that which is rational. We could get off on that question and why that's a sense organ, and that would take up the rest of the evening. And I'd go hoarse and we still wouldn't have finished talking about that. So I'm not going to go there right now. I'll just say, for the time being, in the Buddhist context, there's six sense organs. And there are six ways in which consciousness knows the body and the rest of the material world. Because body and material world, it's all stuff. That's the main issue. So now we know that there are three categories of experience for sure that we and everybody else has. Matter, or body, awareness, and perception, which is the relationship between them. There's something else that the Buddha observed that everybody has and experiences, and that is attraction to what's perceived, or revulsion, or withdrawal, or rejection of what's perceived. The alternative being sort of a neutral sense in relationship to that. And that this is somehow different than anything else. That the impulse to move towards something, the impulse to move away from something, or the impulse to have no relationship to something at all, that that's a unique category of experience. And what I find interesting, and I just read about this in Atlantic Monthly, so it must be true, just read about this in Atlantic Monthly this last week, a psychologist someplace, whose name I can't recall, or where he's a psychologist, has pretty much proven, or psychologists in general have accepted the idea, that there is a mechanism of attraction which is totally different than the cognitive mechanism of rejection, that they're two totally different kinds of things. And the person who's been working on this has been doing this, his research on voter behavior, which is where it comes up, which is there are a lot of voters who basically say, I don't want that person. There are other voters who say, that's who I want. But the internal mechanism for being attracted or rejection, because that's what this is, are actually completely different from each other. The other example that he points out, this one will probably make sense to everybody, some people are really big on not losing money. I don't want to gamble, I put my money in the bank, don't let me near the stock market, I'm not doing any of this kind of stuff. That is one approach, which is avoiding loss. And you don't make money that way. The people who make money don't have that mechanism. They have the mechanism of attraction, which is, I want to make money. These are two very different things. Boy, did that explain a lot about myself to me when I read about that. Because I'm definitely in the put it in the bank and don't risk it category, not the let's go out and make lots of money category. Very interesting. So anyway, so the Buddha noticed this quite a long time ago. So now we've got four categories of things that are actually quite different from each other. If you think about it, attraction and repulsion are really different than any of the other three categories. The fifth category is all the other habits that run us. Because what the Buddha observed is that we're made up of a lot of habits based upon our past experience, based upon the way we've interpreted past experience, based upon our social upbringing, all this other kind of stuff. We have a lot of ingrained habits. And those habits are a specific category, and they're different than anything else. And they control pretty much the way our mind works or our consciousness works. So these five things, in the Buddha's time, they didn't have words like categories and whatnot. In the Buddha's time, they didn't even have writing. So these five things were called the five heaps, because the Buddha sat around and he said, well, we got this over here, and he put a rock over here. And he said, we got this category of things over here, and he put a rock over here. He said, we got this category of things, he put three rocks over there, because we got attraction, repulsion, and neutrality. Then we got this category of thing called consciousness, he put one rock down. That's four, he said. And we got this category called habits, and he put 51 rocks down. Because there are 51 different types of habits, so we're definitely not going to go there. He said, there's nothing else. Said that those five piles contain everything in human experience. There is nothing that anybody experiences that are not in those five piles. Okay, so I started talking about this by saying something about identity. So, everybody in this room is sitting here thinking, me, I. That goes on all the time. It never stops. That's not, he didn't say anything about that. Where is it? What pile is that in? It could be a habit. Some people think it's a body, it's matter. Some people think it's consciousness. What is it? Well, the Buddha said that if you put all of those five things together, you put a label on them, and that label is me. It's a word, it's a concept that's applied to all of those things coming together. David is just the word, according to the Buddha, David is just the word that is used to designate all those five piles of things that come together that are in this kind of dynamics, flux, changing situation all the time. And that's all it is, and that's all that label refers to, and that's all that David is. Now, that's all David is from the point of view of the name David. Right. So like in the West, we think we have a soul, you know, so that gets into a whole other kind of thing. But the Buddha says, what you've got is a name, you've got a label, you've got a sense of I, which is actually what it is in the deepest sense. You have a self-awareness of I, to which a word, David, perhaps, is applied. But that is designated on, or it's implied on, or it's stamped on that complex of those five categories. And that's all that's going on. Now, that doesn't mean that those five categories are somehow not David or not important. I mean, where's David without his body? I mean, where would I be without my body? I wouldn't be David anymore, that's for sure. Where would David be without his consciousness? Now, that's an interesting one, because some people would say, by about 3 o'clock this morning, there's not going to be any David consciousness. There's going to be a body that's going to be stretched out in bed upstairs, and that's going to be it. So where is David under those circumstances? And that's an interesting conversation, but we're not going to have that conversation tonight. Most of us would agree, though, that the complex of habits which form my personality are really the essential thing that makes David David, plus maybe his body. But that would be the essential thing that makes David David, especially the habits, especially that which is the, quote, personality, the sum of the habits. Be that as it may, Buddha says, and all the Buddhists since him have said, that what the person is who calls himself David, or the person who calls herself Loy, or whatever the case may be, it doesn't make any difference. What that person is these five categories plus this label, David, Loy, or whatever, which points to the way all those categories fit together. And that's it. There isn't anything else. That includes everything. Now, does that include what in the West is called the soul? That's the subject of a very interesting conversation, which we could have at some point. But again, not tonight, because I have some specific things I want to try and do in the next few weeks. Okay. So, but in the Buddhist sense, that's it. That's all there is. There isn't anything else. Raises all kinds of questions about what happens when you die, and we can get into those at some point if you want to. We have in the past, we can again. But this is the main thing. Now, what happens when you start to work with the identity of David, of I? What happens if you start to change it? How do you work with that identity to find what? In the Buddhist sense, probably what's mostly referred to in the West, at least among modern people, as a soul, is the consciousness which is hearing me now. I would guess that given who the people are in this room, if you were to be asked, what is your essence, what is your essential nature, it would have something to do with your awareness. It would have something to do with your consciousness. It probably, for most people, would not be body alone. And it probably would not be habits or personality. That might be my nature, but not my essential nature. I think most people would say it's their awareness. But maybe not their awareness in the ordinary way of, you know, I'm frying eggs in the morning for breakfast awareness, but their awareness of perhaps a slightly different character, perhaps a subtler character. Their awareness perhaps at moments of extreme joy, or their awareness at moments of extreme peace, possibly even their awareness at moments of extreme terror, which is an interesting thought. That place in them that is somehow central at the core, that which we've glimpsed at times is the essence. I think most people might say that. Maybe when we do a Q&A, you can tell me if I'm right about that or not. At any rate, what the Buddhist path is about is finding a way to get to that core awareness, which is actually in us now. I mean, that's the awareness which is aware of my habits. It's the awareness that's aware of my body. It's the awareness that's aware of what I'm attracted to or repelled by. But getting at that sheer, mere, pure awareness is a challenge. And that would be essentially much of what the Buddhist path is about. And if you don't think it's a challenge, then try not to be distracted for a minute. Try to merely be aware of one thing for a minute. It's not easy. To sit in that awareness, to sit in that mere awareness at peace, is a great challenge. I find that as I get older, it's a greater challenge. And I find that the internet has made it even more of a challenge, and my cell phone has made it even more of a challenge, and my job makes it a challenge. It's like there's this constant cacophony of stuff that goes on that drags my attention around. And it's very hard for me to just sort of like get back into what am I and just hang out in that place. If I can get there, I'm much more peaceful. The craziness at the university is a whole lot less crazy. The eggs get cooked better, and so on and so forth, because I don't forget to notice what they're doing and so they don't burn, etc., etc. So, that, finding that, sitting in that, being in that, which is, again, to use Buddhist language, one's Buddha nature, essentially one's enlightened nature, is what this meditation practice gets at, because what prevents, again in Buddhist terms, what prevents your ability to hang in that place, to seat yourself and relax into that place, is the way in which all those five things relate to each under other, more or less under the governance of the sense of I. And if you can change that sense of I, then you can change how all those parts fit together and relate together, and you can get to a place where the craziness can stop. So, that's enough for tonight. And I'll come back to more about that idea of that I and what you do with it in 2 weeks, if you come back in 2 weeks, which that's your choice. So, okay? We'll take a break at this point.
Yeah,